legends and lies become history by sheer repetition, wrote the historian Thomas Dotson, a native of southern Appalachia and a descendant of both the Hatfields and McCoys. The story of the Great Blood Feud between those two families has come to symbolize a distinctly American brand of clan warfare. But Dotson, with good reason, believes that the conventional story of the Great Hatfield-McCoy Feud of the late 1800s is a supersized fable, woven together from cultural misunderstandings and outright lies. That story has given rise to an indelible image of rival clans of mountaineers wearing floppy felt hats and faded overalls, skilled in making moonshine, toting shotguns, and suspicious of all strangers who trespass on their family's land. This stereotype of the once dangerous but now nostalgic hillbilly, recreated in theme parks, restaurant decor, movies, comic strips, and TV sitcoms, has shaped the national vision of Appalachia. Yet it mistakenly brands the region's rugged terrain as the homeland of a primitive people whose isolation and backwardsness dooms them not only to endemic violence, but to an endless cycle of poverty. Today, almost 120 years after the end of the Hatfield and McCoy hostilities, stories about the feud remain vivid in local folklore. The historic locales associated with the conflict have become popular tourist attractions, drawing an estimated 100,000 out-of-state visitors each year. The story of the feud evokes a unique kind of Appalachian nostalgia, harking back to a time before the arrival of the coal companies, the mine accidents, the brutal labor strife, the environmental degradation of a once rich environment, and the chronic health problems that plague so many Appalachian families. What is it about the Hatfield-McCoy feud that still captures the imagination? As Dotson put it so well, the Hatfield and McCoy feud is not history, it's a story. And as a story that has been turned into an industry, growth can come only by exaggerating the myth. For the Hatfield and McCoy feud has become a nostalgic fantasy that skillfully and colorfully conceals what really took place during the late 1800s in the deep hollows of southern Appalachia. Welcome to Places of Legend, a podcast that digs into places with stories. Stories that are shared in schoolyards, on sidewalks, in urban legends, age-old superstitions, and internet memes. It's far from the history that is usually taught in school books. Let's call it cultural heritage with a weird and unexpected twist. The legends can be scary, they can be hilarious or grotesque, and the truth behind them is almost always hidden. Places of Legend offers up stories that pull back the curtain at famous historic sites around the country. Historic places with very different stories to tell. I'm Angela Labrador, and with my colleague and author Neil Silberman, we hope to turn your ideas about America's places of legend upside down. In this episode, our place of legend is the rugged borderland between Western West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky, a place neatly divided by the deep green winding waters of a river called Tug Fork. It is a landscape of narrow valleys and steep ridges, rough and isolated terrain colonized by Euro-American pioneers at the end of the 1700s, long after the choicest land on the eastern seaboard had been acquired and occupied. A mixture of ethnicities put down their roots in this area, including Scotch-Irish, English, Germans, and French, and they established a unique way of life. They farmed the narrow valleys as extended family units and supplemented their crops by hunting the plentiful wildlife in the thick forests that surrounded them. When later generations sought new lands to settle, they headed toward the fertile hills and plains of the Midwest, while Appalachia remained an undesirable cul-de-sac. As the cities of the East Coast became industrialized and the nation expanded westward, the Tug Valley and much of Highland Appalachia remained among the country's most inaccessible and isolated areas. No railroad came. No factories were built. The roads disappeared into the forests. Families continued to live by small-scale farming and by hunting game. But beneath the surface of the forests and ridges, beneath the isolated cabins and the tiny villages, lay an unimaginably rich vein of anthracite coal. The hard, black, carbonized fuel that would provide power for America's railroads, foundries, and steel mills, and eventually the electrical power plants that would, by the late 1800s, turn the urban night into day. Today, the once heavily forested ridges of the Tug Valley are scarred by strip mining. Dozens of mines have closed or gone bankrupt, and many residents still cheer for politicians who loudly support the return of big coal. At the same time, the colorful image of the feuding Hatfields and McCoys harkens back to a more idealized time, an era of Appalachian independence, freedom, and power before the coming of the mines and their company towns. When did the feud begin? Some say it was connected with locally lingering conflicts at the end of the Civil War. It was then that Asa Harmon McCoy, who had enlisted in the Union Army, was mustered out of service and returned to his home. Legend has it that a group of Hatfields with Confederate sympathies murdered him in cold blood in January of 1865. A green roadside marker erected by the Kentucky Historical Society and the Kentucky Department of Highways in the town of Blackberry now commemorates the place of the ambush, noting that this was the first incident between the two families. Bad blood must have persisted, because some 13 years later, in 1878, a bizarre trial over the ownership of a single pig put the McCoy and Hatfield clans in direct conflict. A reconstructed log cabin over in the village of McCarr recreates the scene of the dispute, where the leader of the McCoy clan, Ol Ranal McCoy, sued Floyd Hatfield for stealing one of his hogs. The judge understood the danger of the situation and divided the jury equally between supporters of Hatfield's and McCoy's. Unfortunately, one of the McCoy witnesses broke ranks with the rest of the family and testified that the hog belonged to Floyd Hatfield. The McCoys were livid, and 2 years later, that traitorous witness turned up dead. Each episode of the feud story seems to build toward an inevitable escalation of violence, with each insult sparking anger that in turn raised the stakes. On Election Day of 1882, an occasion when the residents of Pike County would normally socialize, celebrate, and enjoy a day off, Ranal McCoy's three sons got into a drunken brawl with Ellison Hatfield, who was stabbed 27 times and then shot to death. The Hatfields clamored for righteous retribution, and they snatched the McCoy boys, taking them across the river to mete out their own brand of frontier justice. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life. The three McCoys were blindfolded and bound to some pawpaw trees down by the river and killed, execution style, in a hail of about 50 Hatfield gunshots. The execution site at the pawpaw trees in McCarr is now also marked by a Kentucky State Historic sign, which commemorates the act that transformed the family feud into a kill-or-be-killed war. The other landmarks of the conflict, houses, cemeteries, and memorial statues, have benefited from federal and state funds for the restoration and maintenance in the hope that promoting tours and souvenir sales at the Hatfield and McCoy feud sites would stimulate the struggling local economy. Kevin Gilliam, a local architect hired to design feud-related tourist attractions, looked forward to a new surge of visitors fascinated with Appalachia's most famous feud. People already come from all over to visit these places, he told a reporter. From Canada, from Japan, it's unreal the people who are showing up. McCoy feud is a part of American folklore, and its image of escalating violence and retaliation in lawless mountain country has spread around the world. Yet it's amazing that the main evidence for the familiar story that has been handed down across the generations came from the imaginations and perspectives of two big city reporters, T.C. Crawford of the New York World and John Spears of the New York Sun. With word of the Hatfield-McCoy bloodshed spreading beyond the Tug Valley, the national press had become increasingly fascinated by the secondhand reports of hillbilly clans fighting to the death in their isolated mountain wilderness. This was precisely the kind of tabloid fodder that their growing urban audience loved. But getting there to record eyewitness accounts of the fighting and to interview the rival clan members wasn't an easy challenge. No railroad had yet reached the Tug Valley, and the journey required days of exhausting horseback travel over broken terrain, through villages and past cabins, where strangers were often greeted with suspicion and viewed warily through the sights of double-barreled shotguns. But Crawford and Spears eventually made it, just as the feud reached its climax with an all-out battle at Grapevine Creek, West Virginia, and the arrest and trial of 11 members of the Hatfield clan. Yet the stories that they produced for their newspapers and eventually sold as sensationalist pamphlets forever branded the Hatfield-McCoy feud as something it never was. The two writers did their best to play up the primitiveness of all the combatants, their poverty and colorful accents, to produce the familiar demeaning image of the hillbilly that rivaled other racist stereotypes of the time.
Whoa! I wonder if this is the right road. Someone playing a violin. I'll inquire from him. Get up here.
Whoa. I do, boss.
What might your name be?
Well, it might be Abe Lincoln, but it ain't. What made you think I was boss here?
Why, I guessed it.
Well, guess what my name is.
Say, did you see a fellow go by here this morning with one cross eye named James?
No. What was the name of his other eye?
As Spears's and Crawford's accounts were distributed more widely, plagiarized, imitated, and reproduced without permission, the story of the Hatfields and the McCoys became far more than a journalistic account of murder and mayhem in a remote region of the country. It became an ethnic slur, useful and endlessly reusable, to depict a population as chronically backwards, habitually violent, and unwilling or unable to modernize themselves. Like other cruel minstrel characters, the Hatfields and the McCoys became the archetypal hillbillies, shotguns ever at the ready, feuding and making moonshine whiskey in their hidden stills.
How long have you lived here?
See that hill over there?
Yeah.
Well, that was here when I come.
Now, you don't mean to tell me that you've lived here your whole life?
No, not yet.
Are you married?
No, no bad habits.
No bad habit, eh? Well, what do you chew that tobacco for?
For nothing. Nobody's fool enough to pay me for it.
The image soon appeared on vaudeville stages, in picture books, and as the punchline of derisive jokes. It was as if a new species of primitive human had been discovered, an alien culture in the Appalachians that was seen as chronically poor and genetically interbred. As industrial life reached all corners of the country in the early decades of the 20th century, the image of the hillbilly gradually became less threatening and increasingly comical, appearing in the movies as toothless moonshiners, dunces, and grannies rocking on the front porches of their cabins, smoking corncob pipes. The Hatfields and McCoys were thus the models for a vision of Appalachia that is with us still. Yet thanks to the efforts of a scholar named Altina Waller, we now know that the familiar story of the feud, so avidly promoted to attract tourists to the area, is as patently false and as intentionally misleading as the hillbilly stereotype itself. Dr. Waller didn't know a whole lot about the Hatfields and McCoys when she received her degree from the University of Massachusetts. But her first job at West Virginia University at Morgantown took her right into the heart of Appalachia. Her curiosity for the social history of the region and her task of preparing a course on the subject led her far afield from the familiar historical narratives that were influenced by the early tabloid accounts of the Hatfield-McCoy feud. Waller discovered that those caricatured tales of supposedly primitive and unchanging Appalachian clan culture expressed urban disapproval far more accurately than it recorded the actual historic events. It was only through her painstaking research into the yellowed land records and trial transcripts in the courthouses of Pike County in Kentucky and Logan County in West Virginia, that an amazing realization arose. Not only was there a radically different story to be told of the Hatfields and McCoys and their culture, but the feud story itself proved to be a mix of exaggeration and pure fantasy. What really happened was a brutal economic transformation that eventually left much of the population of the Tug Valley landless, exploited, and totally dependent on the coal industry. It had nothing to do with a timeless primitiveness, clannishness, or a penchant for violence. It was rather how various groups in the region adapted, or failed to adapt, to a changing American economy. Instead, a few sporadic acts of violence over a span of 35 years were strung together to manufacture what seemed to be a continuous blood feud between two discrete families. Indeed, Waller found through her research and discussions with Hatfield and McCoy descendants that even in the late 1800s, the families were so thoroughly intermarried that no clear clan boundary between them could possibly be drawn. The records revealed that the struggle was not actually between Hatfields and McCoys, but between mixed factions of both families who disagreed about how their traditional ways of life could best be preserved. By the late 1800s, that independent way of life was facing a crisis. The traditional attitude was that the valley's resources were to be shared by all. But as the population grew and families had to divide the limited farmland in the valley bottoms into smaller and smaller parcels, and the once abundant wildlife could no longer be depended upon as a source of food, the Hatfields, McCoys, and their relatives and allies had to turn to other pursuits to survive. Ants Hatfield, immortalized as Devil Ants by the McCoys, was the first to sense a possible solution. But it would mean abandoning the traditional pattern of family self-sufficiency and link the valley to the outside world. Though the game stock had been depleted, the forests of the Tug Valley were still thick. With towns and farmhouses rising across the country, timber was a commodity that the country needed and would pay a handsome price to obtain. Ants Hatfield, despite his lack of even a rudimentary education, emerged in the 1870s as the most dynamic entrepreneur in the valley, hiring large crews from both families to harvest the timber on his property and float huge quantities of hardwood down the river on rafts. For many neighbors and kinsmen, this was a betrayal of the valley's traditional culture of shared resources and family self-reliance. But it made Ants Hatfield a very rich man. And his reputation became so powerful that he convinced a court across the river in Kentucky to award him title to 5,000 acres of fine timberland from the inheritance of his nearest neighbor, a 12-year-old orphan named Perry Klein. Meanwhile, old Ranald McCoy, who was identified by the original reporters as the leader of the McCoy clan, was really nothing of the kind. He was a garrulous, mean-spirited gossiper who reserved his bitterest rumors to defame Ants Hatfield and his timbering crews. But because both Crawford and Spears used old Ranald as their main source about the feud, their stories were not exactly even-handed. The tale of the feud that they both crafted were based on old Ranald's bitterness about his own shaky economic situation and his jealousy of Ants' good fortune. And it is that version of the story that has been handed down for more than a century. Yet the familiar tale of the feud between the Hatfields and the McCoys does not tell the whole story. As the feud reached its climax, a much more fateful conflict erupted as local land speculators and outside industrialists sought to convert the entire valley and the labor of its inhabitants into a major source of America's coal. By 1886, little orphan Perry Klein was now in his late 30s and was a well-educated, well-connected civic leader in the county seat of Pikeville, Kentucky, where he had fled years before when Ants Hatfield took possession of his inherited timberlands. After a successful career in business, Klein became Pikeville's sheriff and eventually a lawyer with close connections to the state's political and financial elite. That new elite did not identify with any particular clan or family faction. Rather, they were a mobile, professionally educated middle class of merchants, lawyers, and land speculators who valued contracts and the potential for profit far above family ties. They were intent on developing and modernizing the region through land speculation and the infusion of massive outside investment into the local economy. And for them to be successful, the old ways of living would have to be cleared as well. The escalating violence between the Hatfields and McCoys became the perfect excuse for the newly empowered forces of law and order to sweep the old table clean. In earlier days, the justices of the peace and other law officers were all family members or neighbors. But by the late 1880s, the small local districts had been consolidated into much larger administrative units under orders from the distant state capitals. Add to that the more aggressive enforcement of illegal moonshine operations and the collection of outstanding debts and bank loans, and the Hatfields and McCoys could both see the writing on the wall. In 1888, the year that the feud ended, and Spears and Crawford sat taking notes about what old Ranald McCoy had told them. The first rail line was established along the banks of the Tug. With the arrival of large industrial installations, the landscape was quickly transformed as timber was harvested on a scale that was previously unimaginable, and massive mines were established in the winding valley that became known as the heart of the Million Dollar Coal Field. Company towns were established throughout the valley, where formerly self-sufficient mountaineers became deeply indebted to the company's store. After 1890, the remaining residents grew dependent on coal mining for their survival, and the investors and land speculators profited mightily, with the value of land in the Tug Valley increasing by more than 400%. By that time, Devil Anse Hatfield, whose early success had angered some of his neighbors and kin, had moved out of the valley, and his political and business enemies took advantage of the negative publicity surrounding Anse as they went after his land. Overdue debts that had been long ignored or left pending were now quickly brought to trial, with judgments against Anse Hatfield rendered in every case. Threatened with bankruptcy, he surrendered, not to the McCoys, but to the agents of industry. Needing quick cash to settle his accounts and the lawsuits against him, Anse sold his lands to an agent for a group of East Coast investors who soon established their own mine. As Altina Waller put it, what began as a dispute between neighbors over timber rights ended as a symbol of conflicting historical forces, with ramifications far beyond the two families or even the two states involved. The Hatfield-McCoy feud was merely a sideshow. Even if one side or the other prevailed in scattered acts of revenge and violence, they were both ultimately battling gigantic, national-scale forces of industry and mineral extraction, against whom they were doomed to lose. ATVs echoes through the hollows and ravines of the Tug Valley, which is now a part of the Hatfield-McCoy Trail System, funded and maintained by the state of West Virginia as an economic development project. On the other side of the river, Hatfield-McCoy feud tours are promoted, and the County Convention and Visitors Bureau organizes popular and locally profitable hillbilly days every spring. Advertised as an ideal destination for family vacations, the towns on both sides of the valley revel in the renewed notoriety that the feud of the Hatfields and McCoys has brought. For today, the tale of the feud between the Hatfields and McCoys that popularized a primitive hillbilly stereotype now serves the people of the Tug Valley as a proud regional symbol of independence, fierce family allegiance, and the natural right to defend their land. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Places of Legend, a podcast in which we explore historic sites where the forgotten and unexpected meeting of past and present offers a new kind of heritage experience. Our aim is to share our curiosity about out-of-the-way places and forgotten events. And we invite you to visit our website at placesoflegend.com, where you can find maps, photographs, and links to further information about the sites we explore, including the music heard in our episodes. In our next episode, will travel to St. Paul, Minnesota, and follow the trail of Prohibition-era bootleggers and the federal agents who were hot on their trail. St. Paul had a long reputation as an asylum city for gangsters. The city was filled with speakeasies and bootleg liquor flowed freely. But in the next episode, we'll explore one of St. Paul's strangest Prohibition stories. Was it possible for skilled bootleggers to distill cheap perfume into 100-proof booze? Were 70 jugs of dark-colored liquid hidden in a storeroom of St. Paul's most famous hospital evidence of an ingenious Prohibition-era scheme? We'll follow the clues that lead to a small St. Paul cosmetics company accused by the federal authorities of participating in a vast national conspiracy to smuggle alcohol. Until then, thanks for listening, and we look forward to joining you in discovering more places of legend, available on iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and on our website at placesoflegend.com.